Como ustedes saben, hay una interés
institucional y además de la institución y además de para ver si sale
ciencia, forense, economía de las bases hay una controversia grande
de
su aceptación o no
about su utilización
y proyectos de ley ya en curso sobre el tema. Tiene la visión del de que ve la bien o mal, pero que tiene la visión externa y queríamos compartir con ustedes esa visión y que él nos contara la historia de un proyecto que se parece al proyecto Inocencia de los Estados Unidos, pero que es dirigido por una institución a la cual está vinculado. Él vino a cubrir el Mundial de Fútbol y nos planteó la oportunidad de hablar con nosotros. Nosotros le dijimos que sí, que es interesante conocer la visión y ese ser la metodología que nos planteamos cuáles han sido los debates y podemos intercambiar ideas entre todos y lograr una visión del tema sin ser una posición doctoral o una visión de ese tipo, sino un conversatorio de intercambio de ideas y aprender las
experiencias.
Como dijo el doctor Rodrigo Morales, pues durante la residencia me hice un intercambio con la Universidad de la Complutense, con la de Valencia, y ahí fue donde tuve la oportunidad de conocer a Santos, y por me parece que él maneja todo este tema muy importante. Y aprovechando también otra vez la coincidencia de venir acá, porque claro que quisiéramos este ejercicio acá. Voy a leer acá pues, brevemente, antes de iniciar, una reseña de Mr. Santos, tomada de su página web. Bueno, periodista en inglés, en freelance, desde 1990 ha publicado varios medios de comunicación, incluyendo artículos en The Independent, The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph, The Express, The Web, The Voice of America, The Times Online. Ha aparecido en radio y televisión de la BBC en el panorama de Canal 4. Tuvo alguna participación en la aclamada película En el nombre del padre, que fue nominada a Oscars en alguna escena afortunada por una de esas escenas, que es una película irlandesa. Su primer libro, The Cartage Tree Lineage Wives. Su próximo libro será publicado este año, traducido al español sería algo así como Más allá de la duda. Él me dice que este año porque todavía no alcanza el principio del otro, y otro que se titularía Reivindicación. Comenzó a trabajar en temas de justicia del 90. Su mayor éxito es el increíble caso de los cinco Cátiv, cinco hermanos y primos. Su trabajo como periodista contribuyó a la exitosa apelación. Es decir, a que reabrieran ese caso después de que están condenados injustamente esas personas.
Journalist work as a,
luego,
work as a journalist,
convenció a las autoridades a buscar al verdadero asesino junto con la mamá. Creo que esto es parte del tema que él nos va a explicar hoy. Su libro tuvo un gran impacto, el verdadero asesino fue atrapado y castigado, y así mismo trabajó en varios casos exitosos. Experiencias consultor en temas de ciencia forense, ha contribuido a hacer historia legal en Gran Bretaña varias veces. Es el fundador y escritor principal en el proyecto Sport Magazine. También ha sido invitado a conferencias en la Universidad de Lincoln, Nottingham, China University y la Universidad de Portsmouth. Los clientes de su trabajo de asesoría incluyen a Ken Livingstone, en ese entonces alcalde de Londres, sobre la reforma de la policía, sobre los mecanismos de denuncia contra la policía y de base de datos de ADN, el uso del deporte en el post-tratamiento y la prevención del delito. Me dice que yo, o hasta el momento, he podido como más de 150 casos de reivindicación del sistema de justicia, casos en que el sistema se equivoca, inocentes van a la cárcel y pues el poder de la prensa logra que se arreglen los casos y se haga justicia. Esa ha sido como la línea de trabajo de él, más o menos. Es de esos 150 casos, entiendo que él nos quiere comentar como al menos uno o dos. Uno de esos es el de su libro. Entonces, esperemos que disfrutemos el evento.
So now he's inviting everybody to the event and handing over to you.
Señor Pedro Morales y José Rodolfo, muchas gracias. I will begin in by describing how I started in the work that I actually do, and the way I think this will work best is if I speak a little bit about various topics, then I'll stop so that you can ask questions based on that particular topic, and then we can sort of move on, because otherwise you may forget what you want to ask me. So it all started in 1991 when I heard about the case of the Cardiff Three, as they were then called, although for reasons I'll explain later, they really should be called the Cardiff Five. And what happened was, there was a very, very vicious murder in an area of Cardiff called Bute Town. The murder involved over 50 stab wounds. The poor woman's throat had been slit twice. She was obviously going to die, but the murderer continued to stab her, over 50 times. This meant that it was obviously, at that time, the most brutal murder of its type in Welsh history, and that an early clue was that some blood in that flat had been shed by the murderer, and it was absolutely clear that this was the case, because it was completely different from the blood grouping of the victim, and it lay in places that it could not have done if it had not been shed at the time of the murder. This went on, so they basically knew that they were looking for one man, and later a photo fit was put out of a white man, and the head of the inquiry said that he had the blood of the deceased on him. This turned out to be completely incorrect. That white man had nothing to do with the murder, but it shaped the way the investigation went. They were looking for one white man, but 10 months later, they arrested five men, none of whom were white. The evidence against these men was frankly ridiculous, and the scientific evidence in particular, for example, the blood grouping, clearly showed that it was not these men. They should have been eliminated immediately. They also considered DNA testing, which at that time was in a very, very rudimentary state. It was the system used was multi-locus probe DNA profiling. It's now considered Stone Age DNA, but at that time it was the best that was on offer. It showed that these men should have been excluded. But instead of that, the police and a scientist came up with an explanation, which is actually correct, that they couldn't eliminate the victim on the basis of possible interference with the chemical, fingerprinting chemical called ninhydrin, and also that degradation may have caused a band to move out of place. Now, to fast forward a little bit, because there's so much about this case that I'm not going to be able to go into. What I can do is, as of course I would, is recommend my book, because it does actually go into a great deal of detail about that investigation and the case itself in a way that I can't really talk about at the moment. As the reason I can't go into too much detail about the evidence is, eventually this case was resolved. It was the first case in British history in the DNA age where the real murderer was brought to justice after a miscarriage of justice. This is what I refer to as vindication, which I will come on to later. But going back to this particular case, the end result of it is that in 1990 there was a trial. Three of these men were wrongly convicted and two were acquitted. The evidence was the same. 2 years after that, they won their appeal and were released. And this is where the problems really started, because our criminal justice system works on the basis of, when you face trial, you are innocent until proven guilty. But what happens if you are actually tried and you are not found guilty? Do you get the presumption of innocence back? In practice, you don't. In theory, you do. As the law actually says, you have never had the presumption of innocence taken away from you. But the fact of the matter is, once you face trial, most people will think, no smoke without fire, the police must have had a reason to arrest them, and therefore they got away with murder. The problem with this case is, they not only did not get away with murder, they were quite obviously innocent from the very start. And the benefits of all of this is that I then continued to work on this to actually find out who the real killer was, because I believed very, very early that this case was unique in British history, and that you could find the real murderer and that DNA was going to play a major part in doing this. But before you could do that, you had to put pressure on the authorities to reopen this case and reinvestigate it using modern methods. And that is eventually what happened. So we now sort of move on. I published this book through the Fitterdin Project in 1998. And a year later, the very same police force that had got this wrong in the first place reopened this case. And they used, that this was the first ever cold case investigation of a miscarriage of justice in Britain using modern DNA techniques. They decided they were going to look at this properly, and there has been a sea change in the attitude of South Wales Police.
Todo esto empezó en el año.
Desde buenos días.
They said, since you said good morning. Okay. Todo esto que comenzó en el año 1993, cuando en la ciudad de Cardiff una mujer fue asesinada de forma violenta. Recibió casi 50 puñaladas, dos de ellas en la garganta. Y a pesar de que las dos primeras fueron la garganta y que evidentemente ella iba a morir, el agresor pues siguió atacándola de forma viciosa. La policía empezó a buscar más o menos a una persona de color blanco y finalmente tuvieron 5 personas indiciadas, pero ninguna de ellas el DNA pues era un match para poderlos indiciar. Sin embargo, la justicia siguió y 2 de ellos fueron finalmente declarados liberados de los cargos, y 2 de los 2 siguientes, los otros 2 fueron condenados después de todo. Y luego, debido a este proyecto que él tiene de Fit In, se logró reabrir el caso, que fue el primer caso frío. Un caso frío es un caso que se cierra y no se vuelve a tocar, pero que después, por una razón u otra, es reabierto. Entonces este es el primer caso frío que se volvió a abrir en la historia de la Gran Bretaña. Entonces, debido a esto, estas 2 personas fueron liberadas, exoneradas de los cargos. Entonces pues quedaba la pregunta de, entonces, ¿dónde está el real asesino de esta mujer? El cual pues gracias a pruebas de DNA que fueron avanzando y dieron una mejor certeza, entonces se logró dar con el asesino. Él aclara que cuando estas investigaciones iniciaron, el DNA en el uso forense era muy rudimentario y todavía tenía muchos errores. Entonces, que ya ahora pues eso ya no es así. Él dice que su libro describe perfectamente estos casos para los que estén interesados.
Sí. It gets to the stage where the police have reopened this case and they're starting to investigate it. First of all, they investigate what happened in the original investigation in order to identify that there are lines of inquiry and opportunities weren't missed originally. One of the things that the original investigators must be given credit for, and it is unfortunately one of the very few things you can give them credit for, is that they actually stored the samples very well. They kept virtually everything. This was later to prove to be very, very important. The reason is that, as I said earlier, the murderer had shed some blood. What happened is, in the course of his frenzied attack on the unfortunate woman Lynette White, he struck bone and his hand slipped down the knife and down the handle of the knife onto the blade, and that's how he cut himself. And this is actually very important, as I'm sure the pathologists here will know, that you can actually determine in certain cases whether a murderer is likely to have cut himself. And the reason you can do that is you look on the body for surface bruising and marking to indicate whether the knife had a hilt. If it didn't, if you don't see these markings, then you know that it's very unlikely that the knife had a hilt. The next thing you would look for is whether the blade struck bone. If it did, the resistance of the knife and the bone is such that the murderer's hand is likely to have slipped down the handle and onto the blade. And that will tell you that it is likely that among all the blood in the that has been shed is going to be the real murderers, and that is what you look for. So you can then tell the police you are likely to have the blood of the murderer here, and this is, you then determine how you can find it. So you would actually be looking for particular difference. Now it would be DNA, you wouldn't be looking too much for blood grouping, but at that time you were looking for blood grouping. Because they were able to show that they knew that the murderer had cut himself, They then tested, they used as a forensic scientist to review all of the scientific evidence, and he determined what, well, first of all, they tested all sorts of different samples. So you found that on a cardboard box, on a piece of cellophane, and various other places that blood had been found on the clothing of the victim as well. They tested all of this, and they found some blood which had not been shed by the victim. They knew immediately that this was the murderer's blood. They then DNA tested this, and it matched. It was absolutely identical to the samples that you already knew had been shed by the real murderer through blood grouping.
Yeah.
Okay, él está explicando que en el momento que muchas cosas estuvieron muy mal durante el curso de investigación que llevó pues a indiciar 5 personas de forma incorrecta, pero que una de las pocas cosas que se hicieron bien en ese momento fue una buena escena del crimen, un buen cubrimiento de la escena del crimen. Y todas las muestras que se recuperaron, todas las evidencias que se recuperaron fueron muy bien mantenidas a través del tiempo. Eso ayudó que cuando las técnicas se perfeccionaron un poco mejor, estas evidencias estuvieron disponibles y permitieron descubrir que el victimario, cuando estaba atacando a la víctima, se cortó, él mismo se cortó con el cuchillo que la estaba atacando, y alguna de la sangre de él logró llegar al cuerpo de la víctima, y prácticamente hasta partes del hueso de la víctima donde él la estaba atacando. Entonces esa sangre permitió diferenciar la sangre de la víctima de la del victimario y posteriormente producir pues un perfil de DNA del agresor que ninguno de los otros 5 indiciados inicialmente correspondía a ese match.
So now that they've got to this stage, the scientist that they employed, his name was Professor Dave Barclay. He was at that time the head of the physical evidence of the National Crime and Operations Faculty. That was set up after the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry had resulted in a number of investigative leads being missed. So they wanted to make sure that scientific opportunities were never missed again by the police, and they had the opportunity of asking a forensic scientist from the National Crime Faculty to review evidence and advise them as to what scientific techniques could help. Professor Barclay is an unsung hero of this particular investigation, and many others too, in that he not only has helped to prove people's guilt, but on this occasion, and others too, he has helped to prove that people who were imprisoned for horrible offences actually were undoubtedly innocent. And in this particular case, what he managed to do in his review of the evidence was he looked at all the crime scene photographs, and he realised that one drip of blood was getting stronger, the trail, as you moved away from the body. This simply does not happen if it was the victim's blood. It had to have been a trail of blood from the murderer. So he followed where that trail went, and he noticed on the wall that there was one drip of blood which was on its distribution pattern, was part of this trail. So he then looked at it carefully, and he realised that this drip of blood, or drop of blood, would have dripped down the wall, and that it would have actually got to the point where it met the skirting board, and there was a possibility, a good possibility as it turned out, that this drop of blood would have got into the point where the wall met the skirting board. So he then recommended to the police that they cut this piece of skirting board out, scrape away the paint carefully, and see if there is blood there. He was right. There was. It was DNA tested and it matched the other samples that I'd referred to earlier. The importance of this is that in 1988, 3 months into the murder inquiry, the flat was redecorated because it was a health hazard due to all the blood there. What this meant is that this blood had been sealed in that flat for 14 years. It was absolutely impossible for this to have been planted by the police, or anybody else for that matter. And for other reasons, which is the police did not know who the real murderer was. So they didn't have this man's blood, they didn't have this man's DNA. They couldn't, even if they had wanted to, have planted this blood in that flat. So this meant there is absolutely no doubt that this was the blood of the real murderer. Professor Barclay then went through the flat blindfolded. The reason he did that, they built a mock-up of the flat and with the original wallpaper and everything. And the reason they did this was for him to go through the flat blindfolded. Everywhere he touched, they carefully noted, carefully scraped the paint away, and underneath they found blood. And again, they DNA tested it, and again, it had the same DNA profile, that of the real murderer. The importance of all of this is that, one, it shows in certain cases like this, you can reconstruct the exit route of the murderer out of a flat, even if it is 14 years after the event. And secondly, it showed that certain types of paint are actually very good preservers of DNA.
Bueno, entonces, él dice también que, que cuando la investigación se reabrió, pues solo existían las evidencias recolectadas en la escena del crimen que eran visibles. Y el apartamento donde esto ocurrió posteriormente fue ocupado y antes de que fuera ocupado nuevamente fue redecorado, o sea que todas las manchas de sangre y todo quedaron cubiertas. Y esas manchas de sangre no habían sido tenidas en cuenta en el momento de la recolección del trabajo de la escena del crimen. 14 años después, cuando se reabrió la investigación, la policía, con la ayuda del profesor Berkeley de la Facultad de Ciencias Forenses, Nacional de Ciencias Forenses, fueron al lugar y fueron capaces de reconstruir toda la escena del crimen basados en las remanentes que quedaron ocultos por la pintura de la sangre. Entonces, prácticamente pelaron todas las paredes, recuperaron esa sangre y esa sangre dio positiva para localizar al victimario en el lugar de los hechos. Eso pues entonces dio más fuerza al caso porque se estaba alegando que la policía había podido plantar esa evidencia en el lugar de los hechos para encontrar un responsable.
So they've now got to the point where they have all this DNA which comes from the same person that they knew was the real murderer. This now poses a slight problem, as the obvious thing to do is check the National DNA database, which is exactly what they did. But unfortunately, the real murderer was not on the National DNA database. His name is Jeffrey Gafford, but it would require a remarkable and excellent investigation to find him. What they have to do first is because they didn't have the real murderer's DNA on the National DNA database, they had to find him by investigative means. They started by trying to get the cooperation of the people of South Wales. And the place they started is the place that you would least expect them to have started. They went to the originally wrongly accused men, the Cardiff Five, and they asked them, would you please give samples of a buccal swab for DNA testing so we can eliminate you once and for all? The Cardiff Five agreed to do this, partly on my advice, because I told them that it was absolutely clear that as the blood in that flat had not been shed by them, that this new DNA testing system at that time, which was called SGM Plus, would discover that and prove it unequivocally that they had nothing to do with the murder of Lynette White. But before they were prepared to give DNA samples, both they and I realised that this was an opportunity to achieve effective safeguards. Safeguards that would hopefully ensure that people like them in the future would cooperate with investigations. As the real, one of the big problems here was you were dealing with people who had been horribly damaged by the criminal justice system, accusing them of crimes that they quite clearly did not commit, and you needed their confidence. You had to earn it back. It wasn't going to be given for free. And the way we managed to achieve this was by asking South Wales Police to agree to a number of conditions before they would give their DNA. These conditions were to do this openly, so that everybody knew that Cardiff Five were cooperating, and that it was impossible for any tampering with their DNA sample. The safeguards that were agreed were that, one, they would not be asked to go to a police station, they would not be arrested, and they would not be in any way treated like criminals. The police would come to them. They would come to their solicitor's office. They would take the DNA, the buccal swab, in front, obviously from them, but they would do this in front of their solicitor and also media. Once this was done, the sample would be sealed and signed in front of them, and again in front of the media. They would then be allowed, or their representative, the solicitor, would be allowed to go and accompany the sample all the way to the testing laboratory, where they would witness it being signed in. They would also have the right to attend the actual testing and the destruction of any excess DNA. South Wales Police, to their credit, immediately agreed to this, and this guaranteed that the process had integrity. And that is equally important.
Bueno, lo que hace importante todo este procedimiento es que cuando se hicieron ya las pruebas de DNA sobre las muestras recuperadas en la escena del crimen, entonces lo que primero se hizo fue compararlas con las bases de datos y pues no se encontró ningún match en ese momento, pero por lo menos pues ya se sabía el profile, el perfil genético del agresor, aunque no estaba en la base de datos. Por lo tanto, el siguiente paso fue pedirle a la comunidad que colaborara a enriquecer esta base de datos, y a los primeros que recurrieron fue a los primeros cinco indiciados, a los cinco de Cardiff, para que colaboraran. Pero ellos pues no lo hicieron de forma, pues lo hicieron de forma voluntaria, pero pusieron unas condiciones. Lo primero, que se les dieran unas garantías en las cuales iba a estar presente los medios de comunicación, iban a estar presentes sus abogados, y que las muestras fueran tomadas en donde ellos dijeran. Y además que todo el proceso de análisis y análisis y de resultados fuera estrictamente supervisado todo el tiempo, o sea, mantener la cadena de custodia más o menos. Entonces, Esto pues ayudó a crear más, que la comunidad pues creyera más en el sistema, y entonces ayudó a hacer colaborar, a enriquecer estas bases de datos. Dice que esta es una forma pues de crear en las personas que crean en el sistema para que colaboren, para crear estas bases de datos, ¿no? Porque pues las personas de por sí son reticentes a prestar su material genético, sobre todo si saben que posteriormente esto puede involucrarlos en un problema de este tipo.
Well, as was inevitable, the DNA came back and it was not the Cardiff Five. They were now clearly, undoubtedly innocent. Unfortunately, South Wales Police did not apologise immediately to them, as I believe they should have done. But what they did was begin a screening exercise of DNA testing in South Wales area. For obvious reasons, the real murderer didn't volunteer his DNA. So they didn't get very far with this. But to their credit, they didn't give up. What they did was look again at the National DNA Database. And this is actually very, very important, because it establishes that the way you can use a National DNA Database isn't simply a case of looking for a complete match, and if you don't get it, you throw your hands in the air and despair and say, I'm never going to solve this unless the real perpetrator commits a crime that allows you to take his DNA. In this particular case, a police officer by the name of DC Paul Williams decided to check the National DNA Database. Again, one of the key things with this case is the real murderer, the DNA profile, had one allele which was very, very rare. And this was very important because it eliminated 98 to 99% of people on the DNA database on its own. What the police then decided to do, DC Williams, was to concentrate on the South Wales area, believing the real murderer was still there. Why? I don't know, because common sense would have told you that if you commit a crime like that, you're going to run a mile as far as you can and never come back. But he didn't. The police were actually right. The real murderer was still in the area, although they didn't know it for certain then. What DC Williams did was he checked the DNA database and he applied it geographically. He then checked at 8 alleles. That eliminated some more people on the database. Then at 14, there were about 70 hits at 14 alleles. This was very important because one of them stood out like a sore thumb. This person's DNA was very, very similar to that of the man referred to as Cellophane Man. This is the real murderer's DNA. So this means the police have now discovered something very important. You don't have to give up just because you don't have the real murderer's DNA. You can look for a family member's DNA on the National DNA Database. And if you get lucky, as they did in this case, you actually find a family member who has got his DNA or her DNA on the National DNA Database. They now knew the family of the real killer. So that their next move was to ask all the male family members to give their sample for DNA testing. They all agreed. And this eventually perplexed the police, because they didn't get a match. But the DNA was telling them, it's a male member of this family. But they hadn't got a match, so what happened? They went and asked the family again, and they then found out that this boy This 14-year-old boy had an uncle that they had not been told about. That man was Jeffrey Gafford. They then went and asked him to give a sample for DNA testing, and his response was telling. The first response was, "I thought you had someone for that," meaning the innocent Cardiff Five. Three at that point, as most people referred to them. He then also said that, I had sex with her, so it's probably, you would have my DNA in the flat. This was actually very interesting, and it immediately alerted the police to him being the prime suspect. The reason is that when Lynette White was murdered, she was getting undressed for sexual intercourse with a customer. That didn't happen. There wasn't any intercourse at that time, because the real murderer changed his mind, as Jeffrey Gafford knew full well. There had not been a sexual encounter between him and Lynette White. So they, and the police of course, knew that this is what had happened, that there wasn't any, so that this was clearly an attempt to explain why his DNA would be at the crime scene.
Bueno, como era de suponer, las muestras de los cinco indiciados inicialmente, pues no era un match. Entonces, esto pues fue un poco desalentador, o bueno, era lo que se esperaba. Sin embargo, la policía no se rindió, entonces empezó a buscar otra vez en las bases de datos y se dieron cuenta que la muestra de sangre del agresor tenía un alelo muy raro que descartaba prácticamente el 99% de la población de la base de datos. Por lo tanto, restringieron su investigación a solo las personas que vivían en el sur de Gales, de la ciudad donde sucedió los hechos, y empezaron a pedir mayor colaboración de esa población. Lo que hicieron, pues nunca encontraron un match del 100%, pero sí encontraron algunas muestras que se acercaban mucho, unas coincidencias. Entonces, la policía hizo investigaciones y lograron establecer que esa era una familia completa que tenía ese alelo que los diferenciaba de los demás. Entonces, le pidieron el favor a toda la familia que prestara su muestra, que colaborara con el estudio, y obviamente ninguna de las muestras tampoco fue un match del 100%. Entonces ellos empezaron a indagar y lograron averiguar que una de las integrantes de la familia no había querido colaborar, que es el famoso Jeffrey Gifford. Entonces la policía pues lo rastreó a través de la familia, y cuando fue a interrogarlo y a pedirle que pidiera que diera su muestra de DNA, pues él empezó a argumentar primero que pues para qué, si ellos ya tenían cinco personas indiciadas por ese hecho, pues que ellos tenían que ellos ya habían hecho su trabajo, que ellos ya tenían el culpable. Segundo, que él sí había tenido sexo con la mujer, que por lo tanto iba a dar positivo, entonces que pues era como inculparse, y empezó a dar todas las razones de por qué no iba a dar su muestra. Sin embargo, el hecho de que sangre de él fue encontrada prácticamente en una de las heridas de la víctima, pues de cierta forma desvirtuaba todos los argumentos que lo que ponía, pues finalmente el caso fue clareado por ese lado, ¿no?
So, having...
Es que, si alguien tiene, si tienen preguntas, por favor vayan haciéndolas.
This was the.
Yes, a question.
Oh, okay. Well, can I just finish this part?
Okay.
And because we're actually very near the end of this case. So, Having found him, he then attempts to commit suicide by taking a number of painkillers. The police save his life by smashing the door in and taking him to hospital. And on the way, he confesses that he killed Jeffrey Gafford. That he killed Lynette White, and that he sincerely hoped to die. They saved his life, and he then refused to answer questions. A few months later, that happened in February of 2003. On July 4th, 2003, he became the first murderer in British history in the DNA age to plead guilty and to resolve a miscarriage of justice. And this is what I refer to as vindication, because that meant that there was now no doubt whatsoever that the Cardiff Five were completely and utterly innocent. However, 2 years later, a very strange thing happened. The judge had said that he regarded the fact that he had allowed innocent people to go to prison for a crime that he knew he had committed to be the most serious aggravating factor in the whole case. And yet, the tariff, that is the minimum term that must be served before you are eligible to apply for parole, of Jeffrey Gafford was actually less than two of the Cardiff Three received for the same crime. He was guilty, but they were innocent. And somehow, the British government doesn't seem to actually understand that this is a serious problem. That if you treat people who commit crimes like this more leniently than you treat the innocent people, why on earth would any guilty person take responsibility? Why would they not simply take their chances and hope for the best? And that leads into one of our projects, which is called Just Tariffs, which I'll come to later. And at that point, we can now take any questions on this.
Para finalizar el relato de este caso, entonces, esta persona nunca aceptó su culpabilidad. Sin embargo, ya la investigación prácticamente todo apuntaba para que lo indiciaran y fuera encarcelado. Entonces intentó cometer suicidio tomándose un frascado de analgésicos, pero la policía lo encontró y en el camino al hospital él finalmente pues confesó de su crimen, y entonces se constituyó el primer caso de una persona que en el Reino Unido que fue completamente encontrada culpable gracias a esta investigación en el DNA. Sin embargo, los puntos negativos que tiene este caso es que inicialmente a las personas que fueron indiciadas les habían dado una pena, la mayor pena posible según la ley inglesa, pero cuando el juez decidió sobre Jeffrey le dio una pena menor, lo cual pues es algo que no tiene sentido, porque ¿cómo es posible que personas que eran inocentes, si no se les hubiera comprobado su inocencia, hubiesen pagado una condena mayor que el que pagó o el que está pagando la persona que realmente cometió el crimen, que es un desacierto de ese juez?
Entonces, pues, eso es. Son preguntas.